Well, hi everybody and welcome. I hope you're doing great, and those of you in the eastern part of the U.S. in a good, safe place with the storm. Any questions or follow-up comments or clarification from our person? Could I get a management of the background noise? Could I get a management of the background noise? Your microphone is picking up a lot of ambient noise there. Thank you. Questions, clarifications, things that might be helpful for us to touch on just briefly, or any other answers to the questions, the most important thing you'd like us to focus on and what would be your best takeaway. I appreciate those of you who have sent in comments. Your own perspectives of that, and it will influence how and what I discuss. I'll wrap that into our comments. So if you see that we're not exactly following the outline you have, I'm departing a little bit to incorporate some aspects of what's been of or is of particular interest to you. So anything you'd like to add or ask?
Hi, Dave. It's Marcella.
Yeah, hey.
So I have a concern. So I'm having a hard time getting out of my own head. I'm constantly wanting to analyze people and struggling how to break out of that cycle.
Okay. Let me respond briefly to that, and then we can return.
Okay.
A model that I would suggest that each of you consider as coaches is the model of mindfulness meditation. And one way of doing that is to focus just on your breath, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension, focusing just on your breath. Now, inevitably, your mind, your brain, will introduce thoughts or distractions. That's the job description of your brain. Let it go and refocus on your breath. Same with your client. When you get ready to work with your client, get grounded and centered so that you're totally focused on your client. Remain focused on your client. If you have any thought like, am I asking the right question, or, you know, what should, let it go, just like in mindfulness meditation, and refocus on your client. So that model can be useful, because we're about the client story. We're a catalyst for the client story. It's not about us as a coach. It's about the client. So focus only on the client. Begin before it happens. Get grounded and centered prior to the session. And then focus just on the client. And then we have a map, a system to engage. One system, at least, is a simple coaching model to ask the client what they want to focus on, and then where do they want to get to with that focus. Those are the two coordinates of the map that we'll discuss that will guide our conversation, and we'll listen from that perspective with the client as point of reference. So in sports, anything that even distracts for a moment, a nanosecond, is a choke. So get back in flow and have a way to do that. The neural conditioning chart is an example of that. Look at any emotional triggers and what your usual response is, and find a way to get grounded and centered immediately, and then have an ideal response. In this case, it would be just listening and responding contingently to the client. Now, that's a hard work miracle in itself, because that's not the way we usually have conversations, But at least that's one model of how to go about that. Does that make sense, Marcella?
Yes, absolutely. It makes sense. I feel I'm asking the wrong questions.
You're not. Okay, just a second. Let me interrupt you, because if you're responding contingently to the client, you're responding whether it's question or not. The client is the point of reference. So it's not about judging good or bad or right or wrong. It's responding to the client in that flow. So do whatever gets you into that flow and sustains it. Okay? And you can come back to that much later if you're interested after you apply that. So thanks for that. Any other questions or comments or things that might be helpful to talk about just briefly before we launch into our material? But that's a great point. That's something every one of us at the beginning of our developing expertise in professional coaching has to deal with. So that question crystallizes so much of what we work on as a way of engaging and not reverting to the usual way of conversational patterns and talking in paragraphs, like I do, or like in usual social exchange. We're doing a different model. We create a collaborative alliance, focus on the client, and develop the client story. We're the catalyst for the client story. We're not running in plays. We're not deciding what they're going to do. We're not slipping in answers. We're developing the client story and providing a model of doing that. The model that we provide of being grounded and centered and sustaining focus on the client is a model of our performance. That's how this question relates so much to our topic and our process, because it's something we engage in every time. So I think this really captures so much of what a performance flow is like. And we're going to talk more about that and how to develop that, but that's a simple application that we can refer back to. So anything else anybody wants to add or ask? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I'll reserve just a few minutes at the end. If you have questions, jot them down, and we'll come back to them. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance itself. And first, in that, I think it would be helpful to talk about confidence. So reflect for just a moment for you about what confidence is, how you get to a position of confidence, and what that means to you specifically. Just a moment, and how that applies perhaps to coaching. Confidence is a state of mind. It's something that results from being grounded and centered and developing that experience over time. So here's some thoughts about that. First, you'll see in your outline a confidence blueprint. Olympic gold medalist Nuruddin Marcelli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Here's another. Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague of mine in Houston, offered his version. "When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two." Well, maybe that's a little bit beyond confidence, but neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than either expertise or competence. Confidence is a state of mind. Confidence is both art and neuroscience, and initiates access and establishes a mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. So hear how it's a result of deliberate practice and skill development. It's not a prerequisite. A limiting assumption is, well, you know, I really need to be confident before start, or I need to be comfortable in order to initiate this. Those are all limiting assumptions. It doesn't work in that way. Here's an illustration. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two stacks. On one, they added the generic note in the teacher's handwriting, saying, "I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback on your paper." In the second pile, they received a different note. "I'm giving you these comments because I have high expectations and know you can reach them." For those students who received the generic note, 40% revised their papers. For those who received the encouraging higher expectation note, 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections for the good as the first group. Confidence, like any state of mind, is a mindset. It's contagious. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have a certainty, your brain will usually figure out a way. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. I want to say that again, because this is demonstrated in brain studies, and it's something we convey as a coach in our client when we believe in our client. And here's the quote from neuroscience. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient, in that person, to a more creative, integrative state. And that's why I only work in mentor coaching with clients in whom I believe. So success most often has to do with two things. The state of mind of confidence that we engage, whatever endeavor, and then how we manage an optimum performance state, especially under pressure-inducing circumstances. So I want to talk about both of those with you. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your actions. It's initially subjective. It's an emotional regard of a promise that you live into. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. I will make it work. Optimism is the belief everything's going to work out. It's a little bit more abstract, a little bit more passive. Confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. So let's apply the neural conditioning chart. I hope each of you have had a chance to look at that, maybe even schedule a time with yourself to look at two or three at least emotional triggers and what your usual response is to those emotional triggers. So rather than starting with a negative emotional trigger, let's start with a positive one. Here's an example. My daughter wanted me to join her to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the days that she was in college in Boston. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run together the last several miles to the finish line. She then learned how hard it was to qualify for the marathon with both sponsorship and times. It wasn't until way later, after she got her doctorate, moved back to Boston to practice, it became a reality when she qualified and got sponsorship. For me, excited and horrified blended together. Now, I'm a lifetime athlete, but distance running is not my thing. Running has always been in relation to some ball. So I knew I would have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and pain of training to cross the finish line together. Now, one of my favorite sayings is, "Fate whispered to the warrior, you cannot withstand the storm." The warrior whispered back, "I am the storm." So, every time when I trained for the months before, when I would have otherwise quit early or rationalized stopping because of pain, that mantra, I am the storm, sustained my effort. So, and I didn't quit once. Many I am the storms later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. So find your cue, your mantra, whatever works for you. So how does this actually work at a brain level? The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain for rational thought and decision making. So in brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. With any kind of psychological threat or anxiety, the challenge is to regulate state of mind to maintain serotonin balance and sustain confidence. And another transmitter that directly affects confidence is oxytocin. This chemical transmitter mediates bonding and connection and fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be to important others or to an internal ideal. Now, here's a related concept for a coaching application. A conversation that begins with remarks that someone else perceives as authoritative or critical or adversarial, the first few words activates the brain's defensive circuitry of fight, flight, freeze, protection. The stress chemicals, cortisol and adrenaline, boot up that mindset. The listener experiences then some degree of guardedness, anxiety, or even just distrust, and can kind of partially close down for self-protection. The subsequent conversation unfolds then within that mindset. Now, consider on the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system related to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion can foster a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention both ways, and frames the remainder of the conversation. The listener then feels safe, heard, and understood. This is how we establish and what happens in our brain when we establish a collaborative framework with our client. What would you like to focus on? Let's look together is the framework of doing this. It's a collaborative framework where both us and the client are looking at the same thing the client's experience, and the client is experiencing it in a collaborative way. And more openness, more exploration, the goal is understanding and crafting a better system. Building confidence requires, actually demands at times, hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites, but the result of effective engagement. So how can you prime mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset, ultimately of confidence, but initially just of collaboration? Here's how not to do it. This was a coach that was quoted in Sports Illustrated. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, the coach ensured that it was going to happen again and again. Now, a common perception is that the best way to get employees or players or colleagues or children to perform is by pointing out mistakes or threats or being intense. Now, negative emotions grab attention, but a positive focus works considerably better to develop a collaborative framework and ultimately confidence is a mindset. Bonding, personal development, commitment to a group are all part of this. So how we prime mind and brain to prepare establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. I have in your outline 7 strategies for successful priming for confidence. Look at those and on your own time, figure out a way to make it part of your story. Incorporate those principles into how you want to apply that and the situation and the way of going about that. And now, think about how a mindset makes a difference. Now, I would assume most of you have played the game Taboo. In Taboo, you have a target word on a card that you've drawn that you want your partner to say, given single word clues and no gestures. Now, also on that card, with the word you want your partner to say at the top, there are usually about 6 words that would make it too easy that you cannot say or you lose that round. Now, think about how hard it is once you've seen those 6 words not to say one of those 6 words because your focus has already become anchored in those words. If you say one of those words, you lose a point. So often what you should not say can dominate thinking to make it hard to get beyond the taboo words to offer reasonable clues. Same with how our minds and brains work. It's so compelling, magnetic almost, to think about the negative, the problem, the things that will go wrong, instead of staying in the present moment, grounded and centered, and looking together at what's next. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of themselves forward. A whole field of appreciative inquiry, I think, can be applied to coaching. It's how a person or organization can study and define the best there is and then use that information to build on what's already working. Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, she was a guest in my mastermind group. She described the systematic studies with 3 main things I just want to capture and pass on. Focus on what works, enhances what works. Ask about what you want more of rather than problems and barriers. Focus becomes reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. And appreciative inquiry awakens possibility and moving toward an aha experience. Here's a simple example. Studies by Dr. David Copperwriter, a colleague of mine, applying appreciative inquiry, found that asking about problems going into an organization like usual organization consultants do, what are the problems, how are we going to solve it, he had significantly more success in a matched group of organizations where he went in to look at what are the possibilities, the challenges, the possibilities. The question launches the story. Asking about success creates a success mindset. A head athletic coach who attempted to lead his team to victory told him, "I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the players and how to map game strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of them and exactly what to do." He is no longer a head coach. The result was the team wasn't even close to peak performance and winning results. Only later did I work with him in mentor coaching. The outstanding athletes, until he aligned himself, did not feel valued, respected, but felt judged and criticized. So how you engage establishes a mindset and a context. If you tell somebody, there's going to be pushback. If you ask, it engages curiosity and collaboration. And people will commit to what they co-create. It's exactly what happens in our mentor coaching sessions. So let's apply this now both to mindfulness training and to peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as head coach of the LA Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won 5 NBA championships. Now, that was not all. The pick and roll helped some, but what he would do to regulate at times, he would call a timeout and would go huddle with his team on the floor, and sometimes he would just have them focus on their breathing. Sometimes he would tell a brief Native American Indian story. Other times, it would just be simply to relax, to regulate, and to focus on mindfulness and total presence, to reestablish that performance flow. So this is something that what we may find ourselves doing in coaching is to help a client regulate a state of mind and manage emotions. I think that's one of the very most important things that we do with our clients, whatever the coaching and whoever it's with. The essential simplicity, as I mentioned at the beginning, from the question to Marcia, is focus on your breath. That's a model of an exclusive focus and not letting anything else interfere. That was such a great question that Marcella captured to ask that. Couldn't have set it up better, actually, for this conversation. When your mind wanders, which it will, notice that move back to your point of focusing on your breathing or on your client. Being aware of this process is a way of being aware of awareness. This selective attention aligns the energy field of your brain. There's also in the outline, and I'm not going to spend our time doing this, but I would suggest that when you decide to do this, if you do, to schedule a time with yourself, several minutes at least, and go through that mindfulness meditation exercise that you see in your outline. It's a systematic way of progressive relaxation, focus, and aligning energy field with enhanced self-awareness. And also consider ending the meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time as you're aware of a more relaxed state and the steadiness of your focus and heartbeat. Open your eyes when you're done and gradually come back to focus on present awareness. Now, the reason I mention gratitude, there are a number of studies where a focus on gratitude boosts energy levels, enhances resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body, specific immunoglobulins. This mindfulness training can be a specific deliberate practice component for your optimum performance. Physiological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress as well as enhance performance. So let's look at what and how actually you practice on something, deliberate practice. There is a whole area of performance science devoted to this. Are you getting better at the things you care most about? And answer yourself, whether you write it down or just answer in your head, as I ask. Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you, or as much as you want, despite spending a lot of time working hard on them? Now, a prevailing theory for decades held that experience was the key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Yet, this compelling research was wrong. In fact, it was significantly misinformed. Dr. Anders Ericsson spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts and how they become experts, the art and science of how someone practices to become expert, and what they do to perform exceptionally, deliberate practice. Now, here's the zinger. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau unless you really devote yourself with a growth mindset to enhancement. This is usually the result of movement away from time in the learning zone to focus more on performing. An example, a couple of examples. Older and more experienced physicians, paradoxically, can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason for this documented finding initially isn't obvious. While the younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education of experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and the gap should be further widened by years of experience in the trenches. But this is not the case. What's missing, we now know, is deliberate practice. Here's the conclusion reached by Ericsson and colleagues. People don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience doesn't make an expert. Practice doesn't make perfect. It makes permanent. Think about whatever we do repeatedly, we hardwire. So if we do something a little bit off, we're going to hardwire the little bit off as the automatic response. The vast majority of learning and growth occurs during practice, not performance, because this is a part of the mindset of practice. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal and being open to input and feedback from a mentor and from one's own efforts can be significantly more effective than massive repetition and regular practice. Artists, intellectuals, athletes, consistent findings that neither experience nor practice was the real main variable. Deliberate practice was. So it's not about the total number of hours, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours that can make a huge amount of difference. In fact, practice can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark makes your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory, as it's referred to, is a process of myelination, of rewiring your brain. Repetition of specific motor skills requires so much that each time, over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is if you practice a skill in the wrong way, that becomes hardwired too. So the solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher, a coach, a mentor, someone who's familiar with obstacles, and collaboratively look at ways to overcome them. So there are some steps in the outline to change a behavior and a couple of challenges to changing behavior, and that's our mind's inclination to want certainty and create closure. We want immediate predictability, even if it's not the result, at least it's closure and we don't have to keep expending energy. And our brain rewires repeated behavior and it has an error detection mechanism so that anything other than repetition of the familiar, even good change, can read as if something's off. So think about the learning zone and the performance zone. These are two different time frames and ways of focus. In a learning zone, this is practice. The goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master. Expect to make mistakes and learn from them. deliberate practice occurs in the learning zone. Now, in the performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible to execute what's been practiced. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. So, deliberate practice involves five activities in the learning zone: a specific focus, a specific goal, a challenge just beyond a comfort zone, using feedback and adjustments, and doing this in the context usually of engaging the guidance of a skill coach or mentor. A YouTube tutorial can count possibly, but I wouldn't put a whole lot of money on it, to introduce new possibilities. Practice does not make perfect, again. Practice makes permanent. Practice of a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that incorrect sequence. Then it becomes familiar, it becomes comfortable, and we're inclined to repeat it, which etches it further every time. So deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined talent or ability. Deliberate practice always pushes beyond a comfort zone and employs a growth mindset to move beyond what we would automatically and naturally do in repetition. Improvement always resides just beyond a comfort zone. So look at the framework principles in the outline of developing significant skills with deliberate practice. These are stepwise and I think can be really important as you develop this, to focus specifically, have a framework of a fixed time, frame and focus exactly what you want to do, have tangible markers for that, and use expert points of view, whether that's a book, a video, a mentor, a coach. Align what you do with your core values. What you do has to align with your identity, or if it's simply a change, without incorporating it into the bedrock of how and who you are, it'll go away. And for this, one framework is to establish SMART goals: specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-limited. Here's an example of this. A buddy of mine, a New York Times bestseller, Jeanine Roth. I admire her work terrifically, and she was one of the expert content contributors for my mastermind group. And I did not know this about her. I've been privileged to read some of her manuscripts before they go to the publisher. One of my coaches asked her about her writing and how did she edit and what did she do to self-correct? What was her practice? Jeanine said that she never lets any writing be seen by anyone until she has at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses. And as part of this process, she gets feedback from savvy readers to incorporate that. So let's look now at a little different application of deliberate practice in terms of what it does in our brains. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture, the consulting firm, to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics: self-awareness. Self-awareness is the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned to all levels and to incorporate the flexibility to take in new information in order to change and to tolerate the uncertainty and discomfort of making that change. Self-awareness is a particular systems understanding of our self to look subjectively and objectively at our patterns of emotion, behavior, attachment to others, including communication. This is what we foster with our clients, but when we have developed our own story in the most optimal way, we are in the very best position to help someone develop theirs. This is why I think it's so important that each coach do mentor coaching in their own way. I began with a mentor coach just before I began, way back in the day, my coach training, and continued with her through my training into beginning of practice, and have had three mentor coaches for different aspects since then. The ability to see oneself, to recognize patterns, think systematically, are important aspects of understanding our own dynamics and the dynamics of other people. A component of deliberate practice is developing a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of outstanding performance. A mental representation allows us to see meaningful patterns and to live into them. Deliberate practice develops mental representations that enhance and perfect performance and form the foundation of revising an internal model to incorporate the changes, to make them specific. Here are five questions to ask for each performance goal you set. Is your goal specific? Is your goal measurable? Is your goal positive? Is your goal inspiring to you? Is your goal displayed? Is it something you've written down? Is it specific? Erickson emphasizes that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize these execution of skill so that we can do it without thinking about it. Deliberate practice is designed for these representations to become the default mode. A question. Do you remember a specific moment in a performance you did? Any kind of performance, intellectual, physical, skill, or an outstanding play that you executed in any form? Peak experiences are personal moments of lasting positive feeling, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that is unusually intense and meaningful. These can be called flashbulb moments, personal high points of exciting and fulfilling experiences that can be an exemplary moment. It can be a positive representation, and it can contain or highlight a whole set of experiences. And it also can be a motivator and organizer for other performance-based activities. Peak experiences, like peak performance, are most likely to occur in this state of flow, a sustained state of mind that allows access to the execution of a skill developed by deliberate practice. That's what I was describing and trying to find a decent metaphor for the question about how do you stay focused on your client and not get derailed by questions or thoughts or anything else that may interfere with that, but stay in the flow of the focus and the engagement with the client. Elite performers have trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. A soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instant of that cornering turn. I've worked with two race car drivers who describe this experience, but have difficulty in really deconstructing the elements of how they do it. The link between perception and action, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous and precisely informed. Another example, I've seen the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, run at an amazing speed and be able instantly to shift course in order to avoid an obstacle or pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern developed in each of these is installed by deliberate practice. So that's what we're talking about here. How do we develop for ourselves and in the collaboration with our client this experience of sustaining flow so that the client can then internalize it and use it to enhance and develop their own story. Now, here's something more recently from neuroscience. Let me tell you the backstory. When I began playing basketball with my son and daughter in the driveway, we would never end on a miss. I didn't even think about this at the time, but they had to make the last basket they shot before we stopped. I just thought it was a good idea. Later, when I coached their basketball teams, every player had to make the last basket he or she shot before we ended practice. It just seemed like a good positive thing to go home on. Now, somehow I knew intuitively that endings make a difference. Even brief, seemingly meaningless endings in our driveway basketball, our Tuesday night team practices before the big game on Saturday. Much later, I would learn of Dr. Daniel Kahneman's research on peak experience, that the two times of the most impactful experience and subsequent memory are the moment of greatest emotional impact and the ending. My son, 2 years later, two years older than my daughter, taught me about the importance of a performance state of mind. With his being the first team I ever coached at his age 8, we would gather together as a group at our home gym on the day of the game, shoot briefly, and go over the few rudimentary plays we had. This was 8 years old. The team would then all pile into my car. Remember, this was a time before seatbelts, and drive to the gym. We would listen to Eye of the Tiger on the way to the gym, a raucous repetition of the song, which they all sing along at high volume, got everybody into their spirit before the game. Now, later, I coached my daughter's all-girl basketball team when she reached age 8. We began each practice in the same way, with a little inspirational talk, teamwork, moving directly into basic and then to scrimmage. It didn't work. They were distracted. They didn't seem to respond. It was like they were there for something besides basketball. I was baffled. As I listened to them and observed more closely, I thought I sensed what I had missed. Basketball was the content of the practice, but their state of mind focused on the process of being together, of playing together. I was urging them to concentrate on being competitive. They just wanted to enjoy themselves and each other. Soon enough, we began each practice sitting in a circle on the court, just talking. It was their warm-up. We talked about styles, color. We talked about a bunch of... It worked. They played better as a team. Same thing for pregame warm-up. We all piled into my car and gossiped on the way to the game. And I thought how strange and how wonderful it must be to be a girl, to win by not focusing on winning, and to apologize when you foul an opponent. An opponent was never a consideration for me. My daughter still contributes to my continuing education by giving me 4 granddaughters. So let's talk a little bit about unlearning. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, subjects picked a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one and then behave according to what they picked. So an introverted person for example, if they picked extrovert, would act like an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They were asked to eat something that they had never eaten before, or read something that they would never have read before twice a week. The remarkable finding, after 4 months, the subject lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. Now, the research team was baffled. This was not a diet thing. It was not a weight loss impact. And they studied until they figured out what exactly was happening. Asking people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. This is story busting, breaking the script. This is exactly what we do in our coaching with clients. We story bust. We break the script and ask the client to reflect or think or do something other than an automatic response. Extending to other choices, to eat, what not to eat, read, what not to, they became aware of their choices. Many, after this period of time, began to ask with each bite, is this in my best interest? They became aware of choice architecture and of the decision-making process in a step-by-step way. This is how they continued to lose weight and got healthier, because they were more aware, instead of just taking a few bites and eating whatever is left on the plate, of the choice architecture of everything they do. Think about how this is what we do in coaching. And this is why I ask each client as we begin, may I interrupt you at some point for us both to focus on this at the time if I think it'll be helpful to us, and I give them permission to interrupt me. So this is how we can look at something and what and how they choose. The brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning must involve, at the same time, unlearning. This is why it's a lot easier for a child to learn something like a foreign language. The beginner's mind is the essence of this process of not having to forget or translate internally, or unlearn something and replace it with a newly acquired, but to simply learn something new. Learning is not a simple acquisition of information, but it's a practiced behavior that's introduced with much already existing behavior in place. This is exactly what we do in coaching. We examine perhaps a habit, an unconscious repetition, a default mode with a client to look at how they decided to do that or what they think about that. Change can occur, but it's a process ultimately of doing a new behavior and undoing one that it replaces. So this is about how we look perhaps at habits. Our habits have become invisible to us, and we have to become mindful of our choices and the active process of choice in everything that we do. Is this bite in my best interest? We have to keep unlearning just as we keep learning to convert the mindfulness of that default mode of automatic responses into the mindfulness of choice of this moment. This is one thing to think about with our clients, especially when they have a repeated behavior, something that they automatically go into or cue themselves to a state where they repeat negative self-talk or the same behavior, they can't get it out of their head. There are three steps to self-directed neuroplasticity. Being aware is always the first step. So here's the first step. Whenever there's a negative self-talk, a negative whatever, or something that you don't want, but it's automatic. Recognize that automatic old content as an error message from your brain. Your brain is repeating. It's cued to repeat the same thing. That's an error message from your brain. That's your brain's attempt at protecting, at making things automatic, but it's an error for this situation. Reframe the false brain message in terms of a positive focus, a positive endeavor, and then refocus on the next step. So recognize, reframe, and refocus. When we unlearn connections and association, we weaken those connections, which is neuroplasticity, part of changing the brain, of rewiring the brain. It's just the opposite direction. This unlearning is necessary in our neuronal networks to create new room for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, to keep our neural networks from overloading. So this is like pruning an old, unused pathway. And that occurs a lot. That occurs about 60% of the occurrences during our sleep. That's how when we wake up from a good night's sleep, we may be able to think more quickly or more clearly. So here's a final thought. I want to reserve time for a question or clarification about putting something in an output channel. If you were to take a test on a paper, 8 pages in length, which of these methods to prepare for that test do you think would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row and trying to get it as down, as memorized as possible, or reading the 8 pages once, putting down the paper and writing a brief summary of what you learned. Research shows the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in a 50% greater success. It puts it in an output channel. It makes it more attainable, more retainable. An output channel mobilized in the brain creates new neuronal networks and pathways and begins rewiring with the new information in that cycle. In one study, when physician's assistants requested that the patient write the date and time of their appointment rather than doing it themselves and handing it to the patient, it lessened the no-show rate by 18%. And these are repeated in so many different studies, I'm gonna spare you. But simply to say, levels of deliberate practice include mental and physical combinations and execution. All performance expertise involves deliberate practice, working on developing the skill and putting it in output channel. There are no purely motor skills or purely cognitive skills. It's a synthesis of learning and expression. Here's a final study. Some of you have heard me say this before. University of Waterloo showed that people learn better in a particular way. A large group of people read the same passage in a book. They all took a test. Half read the passage out loud, half read it silently. They all took a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. So this process facilitates attention and retention. It makes it your story. This is why I think it's so important in a coaching session to complete that coaching story. In each coaching session, is its own story, beginning, middle, and end. At the end of that session, with at least a little bit of time left, what's the most important thing you're taking away from our session today? And get the client to put that in a sentence. It will be much more meaningful. And based on that, what do you commit to do before we meet again? When somebody commits out loud, it creates a way of wanting, needing to respond according to their own identity because they've committed to do it to themselves and out loud. 18% more show when they write down the appointment themselves. So I'm going to put us on discussion mode. I hope to have more time. 1 second. In just a minute or two, any questions, clarifications specifically about anything we've talked about? Well, look at the outline, reflect on what we've talked about, and if there are any questions, fire them off in an email. Any additional answers to those two questions I asked initially? Otherwise, we'll pick up right here next time. I look forward to that, and I would welcome hearing from any of you, any responses or feedback. Thanks very, very much. Bye now. See you guys.